Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Seeking Justice on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin. For the next 60 minutes, I will be your co-host along with Kim Colton. Kim, greetings.
Yes. Oh, thank you. Hello. It's nice to be here tonight. How are you this evening?
I'm great. And yourself?
Absolutely wonderful.
Okay. We've got to, we're calling the show tonight a special edition in the sense that we're not going to be profiling a specific case. And we have two great guests with us tonight. And I will introduce, first of all, Patricia Caristo. And Pat is a professional investigator with 30 years of investigative experience, 8 years as an investigator with the Philadelphia Police Department, 5 years as a detective at the University of New Mexico Police Department, 5 years as a special agent and intelligence analyst with the New Mexico Organized Crime Prevention Commission, and 15 years as a licensed private investigator and director of NIA/NM, a nonprofit investigative agency offering pro bono service to victims and or families of violent crimes and crimes involving the elderly. Pat, welcome to Seeking Justice.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be invited.
And Kim is going to introduce our second guest.
And that would be Lois Duncan, who is a established writer. And Lois, you have won many awards, I see here. And you have many books that you've written. And one in particular is one called Who Killed My Daughter?, which is nonfiction, and that is about your daughter, Kate Arquette. And you also have a great website called Real Crimes that you got up and going, and it's a great website. And we welcome you to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be included.
Thank you. So, what should we do first here? Let's see. Well, Pat, I was wondering how you got started with being a private investigator.
Well, I had been a law enforcement investigator for about 17 or 18 years, and I had finally needed a second back surgery. That second back surgery took me out of my law enforcement commission status because in order to maintain your law enforcement commission, you have to do the firearm certification, and I was unable to run to get prone to fire in the positions necessary, so I couldn't maintain my law enforcement certification. I saw an ad in the paper, a woman who was the original owner of NIA, which was originally National Investigations Agency of New Mexico. She wanted to go to law school and was selling her business here in New Mexico. And from a recovering back surgery bed, I took over NIA. I had been a licensed private investigator for a couple of years before that.
Oh, well, that's kind of now you do you miss the other work you used to do? It's basically probably pretty much the same, but
actually,
I
it is pretty much the same. And yes, I did miss law enforcement for a long time. I felt that it was a very honorable profession to be in. Private investigation was a little off-putting to me because you had to deal with people about how much things were going to cost, and you had to make that negotiation up front. In law enforcement, there was a crime, there was a case. You just worked it and didn't think about the money. And so when I ultimately changed from a for-profit agency to a not-for-profit and didn't have to talk to people about money, that made me happier again.
And that is so interesting that you are in changed it to the not-for-profit. I commend you. That's just... That is wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about that part of it?
That came out of the Caitlin Arquette case primarily. At the time I became involved in the Arquette case, I was still an active private investigator in a for-profit mode, but I was also doing volunteer services and then ultimately served on the advisory board of New Mexico Survivors of Homicide. And these are families who have survived a homicide. And I thought the title was so interesting that they did not want to be victims, but to survive the homicide. Their loved one was the ultimate victim, but they saw themselves as survivors, and they all worked together with other family members, sharing, caring, fighting battles, and Lois was part of New Mexico Survivors of Homicide. And when I became involved with Kate's case and some of the other cases with New Mexico Survivors of Homicide, I became aware that families just could not afford the protracted investigation that it takes to do these unsolved cases. And so NIA self-funded itself. That's not a good English, but we funded ourselves from our regular cases, and then we took on student apprentices who volunteered their time to work on these unsolved cases, and as part of their training to become licensed investigators. And then we've also gotten some wonderful donations from families who made some donations, not directly for their own cases, but to help other cases. So we've been nonprofit since 1998, and we have worked on, I was trying to estimate before we got on the phone, at probably 50 cases, but I'm not sure. Close to that.
Okay. I did want to touch a little bit about your in-house apprentice program. That is really sounds like a neat program. They have to complete the way I think I understand it is that they have to complete a course through the local college there?
No, actually, that's a separate class. That's how I got the apprentices.
Oh.
I started teaching what's called Introduction to Private Investigation. It was an 8-week course. And talking to people about what a private investigation is, how they could use it to be a better writer, a better reader of crime books, and as a fun course and as an introduction to investigation for people who might be interested. And so many people were, and they were thwarted by the fact that it's very difficult to get into investigation in New Mexico unless you have investigative experience. And so with a core group of apprentices 5 or 7 years ago, we started the program, and they apprentice with NIA for 3 years, and they have to work on real cases, and they took on the unsolved cases at my direction as part of their training. And at the end of their time, then they applied to the state of New Mexico, took the test, got the license, and then they went out and became licensed investigators on their own. And their only mandate from me was that they agreed to do some pro bono work.
That is wonderful. I think that is really the way to do it. That's for sure. What do you think, Denny? Isn't that great?
I think it's wonderful, and it seems that we haven't so far, Kim and I am talking about, encountered many businesses. Private investigators, attorneys, that are interested in doing pro bono work. So there's certainly a need for it. I think there's a need for more of it. And I'm certainly enthused, Pat, that you are doing what you're doing. And
our family refers to Pat as the Mother Teresa the Second, which is actually what the kind of person she is.
Lois, I was wondering, would you please tell us and the listeners about your Real Crimes website, when that got started, why it got started, and the criteria for getting a case listed and so forth?
Well, our daughter, our youngest daughter, Caitlin Arquette, was chased down in her car and shot to death in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1989. And because, well, the police dropped off the unsolved case, and there was nowhere to go with it. And because I was a writer with a lot of experience and quite a large following as far as mystery suspense books go, I was able to write Kate's story. It was the first time I had written nonfiction. And it fell onto paper almost as though it were one of my fictional novels. And because I was so used to writing that type of story, except this time it was real. And it got published. And suddenly I was on this circuit. Larry King and Unsolved Mysteries and Good Morning America and Sally Jesse. Actually, when I was on Sally Jesse Raphael's show, that is when Pat Caristo contacted us, because she heard me on the show talking about Kate's case, all the questions we had about it, and Pat had some of the answers. So she contacted us to, without charge, give us information she had about our own child's case. So that's how we met. And I am now getting off the subject, but I thought I'd drop that in while I was talking because it's interesting. And then people began to get in touch with me because suddenly they'd seen me on TV, they'd read the book, they were in the same situation we were, with cases that had not been correctly investigated. They were frustrated and furious and grieving and had no outlet, and they were not in a position to get a book published. And so my husband and I decided we would create a website for them, and I interview the families and help them word their stories. And my husband, Don, will attach documentation like crime scene photos and autopsy reports to back up their allegations. And then we post it on the Real Crime site. And that site is www.realcrimes.com. And what it has become is a resource for the media, for if people want a true crime show, people like Dateline, for instance, would come there to look for their cases. So that is one way that it's useful. It's also useful because we have a message board and we have an email connection so that people with information can contact the families through the website.
How many cases do you have on your site now? I didn't count them. Do you happen to know offhand?
I would guess we're close to 40.
And I sense that at least in some of the cases you do get quite a bit of activity or quite a bit of people contacting the families and that type of thing.
I feel like I'm sort of the godmother of all of them, because by the time I have helped them write their story, I'm so invested in these cases that anything that happens to any one of them, I feel like it's sort of happening to us.
It's got to be, I would think, very emotional thing. I mean, you have the personal experience to kind of appreciate what these other families are facing and are going through. And it's got to be emotionally tough. Is that true or no?
Yes, it is. But also, it gives me a feeling of accomplishment that if we can't solve our own child's case, maybe we can help someone else find the resources that are necessary to solve their child's case. And that has happened in a few instances. And you just feel this great sense of our Kate not having died an empty death, that from her death we got involved in doing something that is maybe helping other families like us.
Mm-hmm. And Kim, I have one quick question for Pat, and I'll let mm-hmm. you get back in.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Pat, I'm curious now. A lot of the cases that are on the Real Crime site and cases we profiled here previously, we have situations where the death has been ruled an accident, a suicide, or undetermined.
Mm-hmm.
And the families aren't, they have their information that probably that is not the case. There's reason to believe perhaps we were involved with the homicide situation. Your investigations, when you do your pro bono work, now do these have to be classified as homicides before you get involved, or could they be something where you have a suspicious death or suspicious circumstances, but the official record is on the death certificate is that it was a suicide or accident?
No, actually, it is any death where the family has unanswered questions. I have two right now that were ruled suicide by law enforcement, and the families feel that they were murders. We have one that was a couple that were considered accident. We were able to determine that there were some other factors involved. It's not the case itself. It's the need for the family. In New Mexico, there's some good support when there's an arrest made in a murder case. District Attorney's Office has good advocates for those families. But when there's a case where there's no arrest made, there's no suspect identified, those families have nowhere to go to get someone to answer a question, to ask a question from, and to get support. The police do their initial investigations, but then when there's no active leads, they're busy investigating new cases, that kind of thing. So sometimes just having a place to go where there's an agency, a group of people that are willing to listen and take a look, and will review the reports, review the files, point out new leads, interview, and be a support to that family.
Pat, how many interviews have you done for Kate's case?
I have absolutely no idea. I just know that I have a case database where there are 500 names, and I know that I've interviewed at least half of those names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one thing that Pat has done that is just incredible. She has set up a database where everything, I'll let her explain it, but my layman's quick explanation is if she puts in one name or an address or anything in there, she'll get all of a sudden multiple links to everything else. And this way, one case can link to all kinds of other cases.
Wow. Well, that sounds easy, except that it's not that easy. And I had to learn the hard way, and I learned on Kate's case that the program is a simple database management program that you can buy. It's called Commence. And one of my first apprentices, who was a computer guy, and I was not a computer person, said, Pat, you're doing things the old-fashioned way. You got to get into this database. And I fought it tooth and nail. I investigated with a yellow pad and a number 2 pencil. And I used to say that because if I worked with a pen, my brain would go so fast and the pen would go so fast that I tended to make many more mistakes. And the number 2 pencil would slow me down. Steve Murley, my apprentice investigator at that time, got me hooked up with Commence. But the problem is it doesn't exist unless you put the information in. So originally, we started making synopses of reports and entered it in that way. And then I understood, finally, that you have to enter in every report, every piece of information, word for word, into the database. And then you have to compartmentalize it as you wish, so that ultimately you can check a name and find out where it shows up in other cases. I wish it existed so easily to just put in a name and it shows up. It's a lot of work, and if it isn't entered correctly, you don't find it. But it's case database that was the foundation, and what is interesting is so many, at least 10, of the cases that I work on link back to Caitlin's case. Names that are in other cases, when I search Kate's master database, those names are in there. And that's what makes her case so fascinating, and why it is still ongoing, why we still get new information or information that refreshes existing information, but it is so complex and it's difficult to solve. But it does link to at least 10 other homicides in New Mexico.
Holy cow.
In other words, whatever Kate knew, a lot of other people got killed for too.
Hello?
Let me say something about case two. When I teach investigation and when I talk about crimes, famous crimes and criminals, you never know the names of any famous victims. You only know all of the offenders' names. And that used to bother me, and I said I do not want to ever forget a victim's name. And I don't call the case by the offender name. I call it by the victim's name. And we just had a 20th anniversary of the murder of Caitlin, and we had a memorial service at the cemetery. And people came who had no direct connection to Kate herself. It's just that Kate has become, because of Lois's book, because of the people's affection for Caitlin and the person that they've learned through Lois's book and through Lois and her family, Caitlin has become the name of all victims, of all young girls that are killed. No one knows their name, but they all say, it's like that girl, Caitlin Arquette. Her name has not been forgotten, and it is an amazing thing, and people would come, Kate did come to her gravesite to be there just to thank this girl that has been dead for 20 years. And it's an amazing phenomenon.
And so this battle has been going on for 20 years. Without divulging anything that could jeopardize an investigation, by getting these new leads, the Pat that you're talking about, and Lois talked about new leads coming in frequently, apparently, do you think that at some point that this is going to be solvable?
You know, I say that I think we will know the answers. Whether or not we'll be able to get a prosecution becomes another matter. But I do believe that we will have an answer. We have so much of the puzzle, and investigations are always like a puzzle, and you can fill in the edges, and that's the easy part, and then you get the connecting points, but it's that one piece, and then when you get that one piece, it makes everything else make sense. We have almost everything. It's just that one piece that will then tie it all in together, then we can have an answer. Now, what happens after that, I'm not sure.
Lois, as a parent, and we have other listeners that are in a similar situation to yours, but let me just ask you, if what Pat foresees happening happens, and the answer, you arrive at an answer, but for whatever reason are unable to obtain a conviction. would that give you, though, some closure? I mean, would the only thing that would actually help you be a conviction in someone going to prison, or would having the answers, and if for some technical reason or whatever you couldn't get the conviction, would having the answer be of some help in the closure of this?
Yes, it would. But I'm in a unique position because if I have the answer, I can write about it and expose it.
Right.
And the truth is, I really am not, even from the beginning, when police were thinking they were going to solve it, and they said, well, you know, of course, we can't do the death penalty. And I said, well, I wouldn't want Kate responsible for somebody's death, even her killers. So, you know, it wasn't a matter of getting revenge. And it isn't a matter of that now. I think, personally, that Kate was probably killed by a hired killer. I want to know who hired him and why.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so just getting the little guy who pulled the trigger, he could very well be dead by now. Who knows? That would not satisfy me. I would want to know why Kate was killed and who was behind it and who was behind what we believe was a cover-up of the case, because those answers are all going to affect other cases.
Mm-hmm. I have a question, Pat, about that computer program that commenced. That sounds so interesting. If you were to put in, like, let's say you had a description of a truck, and it was a particular year, a particular color, maybe had decals or some particular decals or emblems, and if you put that in, and if it ever, let's say it comes up again 2 years later, and you've got the same thing, and you plug it in, mm-hmm. will, after you plug in that information, then will it pull up the other one? Will it connect the two?
Yes, it'll pull up anything. For example, you get an early lead that you're looking for a gray Volkswagen. That's all mm-hmm. you have. But you enter that into and you arrange this database. It's an amazingly flexible method of working. But you devise your own categories, and it can fit so many different kinds of work. But so you have a events section, a vehicle section, a location section, a person section, that kind of thing. So all you have is a gray Volkswagen, and then 2 years later you get information about a yellow Volkswagen, and now but this time you have a license plate, and then. At another point, you have another factor. Then you get this fourth piece of information. Then you submit the inquiry to the database and pull up all connecting material.
Mm-hmm.
Then you pull it up, and then you make your own. The machine won't say X is Y because of Z.
Mm-hmm.
You are, mm-hmm. are the person who makes the analysis, but the data has mm-hmm. to be in. That's why it's so critical to do the data entry. You know, there's a book, a writer, her name is Sue Grafton, and she's written a famous A is for Alibi, B is for Burglar, C is for Corpse,
mm-hmm.
that whole
mm-hmm.
series. Well, Sue, the main character uses 3x5 cards, and that's her way of doing things. And this commenced database is glorified 3x5 cards.
I see.
And so if you have blue 3x5 cards for persons and yellow 3x5 cards for vehicles and green for, and then you have to fill them out. And that's the thing about being an investigator, being a good investigator, that's paying attention to detail and doing the hard work of entering
mm-hmm.
the material. I used to enter the summary of the police report. You know, police report number
mm-hmm.
such and such, written on such and such a date by author such and such, summary. Bad practice for my point, and I had to go back on Kate's case and re-enter everything in word for word, because you have no idea 5 years later whether that word, that name, that partial piece of information is going to be a factor.
Wow. If speaking of different types of equipment that you use,
mm-hmm.
I've always wanted to ask, what other kinds of equipment do you use as far as like audio equipment, cameras, detection devices? I don't suppose you have a phone in your shoe or anything. Remember how?
No, I know.
Get smart.
It was a Get Smart.
Seriously, though, what kind of equipment do you use? Do you use, and what do you find works the best for you?
Actually, every case has its own personality and everything works differently. I do a lot of work for attorneys. They want interviews of witnesses. The attorney will tell you whether they want the interview tape recorded, whether they want a handwritten statement. I don't rely on mechanical equipment except my computer, and they brought me into the computer kicking and screaming, but now I use the computer. But what I teach is, you can go onto the computer and get leads, but you must use shoe leather. You must go down and pull the court file. You must read it for all the little idiosyncratic pieces of information that are stuck on there, that unless you read the original material and people say you have to visit the scene of the crime. Absolutely mm-hmm. critical. But the scene of the crime can be the original police report itself. So you don't rely on bits and pieces. You go and get the original, as close to the original as possible, and you get all the supporting documentation. And you do not, we do not work on one piece of information. You get a lead. We have some wonderful leads, but we take the lead, and then we get at least one more independent verification of that lead. In Kate's case, we have a couple of very powerful leads, but they're only one source leads. And for me, that is insufficient. Your car, your computer, your phone, your fax, your camera, taking digital and old-fashioned 35 millimeter, so that you don't run into the problem of people saying that you manipulated the digital camera. I'm a strict traditional investigator. I also am a very legal investigator, and I don't use anything that would be questionable about voice activated, voice enhancements, and penetrating things that they show you on TV. I don't use those.
Everything
that is absolutely legal. Because if it's not legal, you can't use it, and it doesn't help your family.
That's true. It's not going to help. Yeah. How are you received by law enforcement? How are you received by them?
It's a mixed bag. Fortunately, I don't have much money, don't have notoriety, but I have an excellent credential. Even people who don't like what I do say, I know you're trying to do the best job. That is what keeps my families served. I don't want to be dramatic about saying integrity, but how do you say integrity without sounding dramatic? But even those of people that I'm opposing trust that what I'm doing for the right reasons. And we may be at opposite ends, but law enforcement receives the information. Independent officers receive it in a mixed bag. It depends.
I see. And what about the people who...
I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. What about the witnesses that you that you go to interview? Do they think, are they respectful of you, or do they think, oh, she's not really a cop, I don't have to answer her questions, or do they, how are you received by them?
You know, it's like anything else. If you're polite, if you're courteous, and if you're professional, people will talk to you. You cannot make people tell you anything they don't want to tell you. When I was a police officer, they wouldn't tell me. As a private investigator, they wouldn't tell me. But, you know, an interesting thing is you don't ask people how you did this, did you do this, somebody said you did this. An interesting way to ask the question is, why did you do this? Everybody has a story.
Mm-hmm.
Even the most horrendous killer has a story about why they did what they do.
And they probably like to tell it, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so people will tell private investigators sometimes more than they will tell law enforcement, because I have no hammer to hold over their head, and I can't make them go to court. I can't make them do anything. But you
and
tell
also
them what you're doing.
I think perhaps the fact that you're a woman makes you less threatening.
Sometimes, although that's not true to women. You know, when I was in law enforcement, one of the strategies is if you had a female suspect, you had a male do the interview. If you had a male suspect, you had a woman do the interview. Women don't like to talk to women if the woman is holding them to account. They feel like they can talk to a man differently, and the man will receive them differently. So being a woman helps sometimes. Mm-hmm. Being a woman doesn't help. And there are times when I take a male investigator with me, and there are times when male investigators will ask me to go along. It's like tools in a toolbox. When you need a hammer, you need a hammer, but sometimes you have to use a shoe to get what you need hammered into the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But being professional, representing what's right, and being on the side of right actually gets you more than anything.
Yeah. Huh. I do have a question about Caitlin's case. I really am interested in Detective Merriman. I just feel he has maybe one of those puzzle pieces that you're looking for.
Yes.
But he won't talk.
Well, he has talked. He has talked to me more than once. Our last conversation, he said, I will sit down if everyone sits around the table.
Yeah.
And where people in law enforcement are, some people are trying to make him the bad guy. And he has information. He has more information than he realizes, but it isn't the kind of information that would make him liable. And I just had a conversation with someone just 2 weeks ago and said that he would see if Detective Merriman would talk to me again on the side. But when we met him last, he did say that he would sit down with the cold case unit, but he would want all the parties around the table. And that hasn't happened.
I'm willing to sit down
with anybody.
Mm-hmm. I can see where he might want that, you know, where he would feel, well, let's get everybody in on this. And, you know, when I point a finger at them, they can't wriggle out of it or whatever. I just feel ever since I heard this case, when I first read about it and I first heard about it, I just so in my gut just felt that he really held a key on this one.
He doesn't even know he holds. That's the interesting thing.
Yeah, I think a couple of the cops connected with this case were made scapegoats by their own department.
Which that may probably did happen to him.
And
he's retired, right?
Yeah, and that I Pat and I have not always been in agreement about who we trusted and didn't trust in this, but I have of the people at the scene, he is not the one that I personally think was the bad guy.
No, I agree with you. I don't think he was maybe the bad guy, but I think he knows who the bad guy is.
He may know now. He may not have known at the time.
Yeah.
He may have been manipulated at the time. For some reason, I'm inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt.
And Pat, how do you feel? Are you inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt? Not as much?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that over the years, people have given us information. Again, some of these one source information that I will not go beyond if I can't find a supporting piece of information, it just sits there, and it's one of the kinds of information in the database. I viewed Detective Merriman differently in the beginning than I did later on in the investigation. I would see him now as a source of information and not a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people can be corrupt dead without even knowing. And that's the sad part when you get somebody doing the wrong thing in an department. And I was in law enforcement, pro-law enforcement, proud to have been law enforcement, and valued my badge. Could honestly say that when I was on duty, I was a better person than I am as just me. I held that badge and that role and the responsibility in high esteem. And I trusted most of the people that I worked with. Originally, I trusted everybody that I worked with. After working at organized crime, after working 18 years in law enforcement, after becoming a private investigator and working in other aspects, I see that it only takes one person to pass on the wrong piece of information to somebody very well-meaning who acted on that information, never knowing that it was wrong. And I think that has happened in Kate's case. That there were pieces of information put out so that good working officers thought they were working with legitimate information and don't even know to this day that they were manipulated.
Yep, I can see where that would be, and that certainly is something that you don't want to have happen, is to go off a piece of information that you can't corroborate with anyone else and then have it be wrong. You know, I completely agree with you. Yes,
but
definitely.
But you get it, and it sounds, it's the piece of information you want. We've been waiting so long, and you get this piece of information, and you want to jump at it. And I have to say, it looks good, but unless I can find a second piece, it just has to sit there in the database till we can work it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's frustrating for families.
Right, oh, exactly. What if you were to say to him, look, it'll probably never come to court, but, you know, help the family get closure, you know, tell us everything that you know so that we can try to put this to rest? Would he
does he
talk to you then?
That's the inquiry I put out a couple of weeks ago. I'm waiting to see if there's a response. I do too.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to be able to trust me. And,
that's,
you know,
true.
It's hard. How does he know he can trust me?
Mm-hmm.
He has been told a lot of things by other cops. He has been told that we have accused him of killing Kate, which we have never done, never entered our heads that he would killed Kate, but other police officers have told him that we've been saying this, and therefore that automatically turns him against us. So an awful lot of disinformation as compared to misinformation, disinformation has been circulated that has made people angry at us about things we've never said or done.
Well, I suppose he's just going to have to, I think even if he just reads your website, he'll know that that probably isn't the case, but, you know, he's being played for a fool if he believes that, so, in my opinion. There was one other thing, and we had a question in the chat room a while back, and it is, Pat, are you involved in any of the cases in the news as a PI?
You mean the bodies on the West Mesa in
Albuquerque? I believe that's what I thought of. When I read that question, that was the first thing I had thought of. I thought, oh, my goodness, when I saw that on the news, I couldn't believe it.
Yes, actually, I do have a case that I provided APD information on that may be one of the people there. So far, everything has come back that they don't match it. Her name is Teresa Reyes. She was a 17-year-old.
Oh, sure.
She was a 17-year-old
mm-hmm.
girl that went missing.
She's on our Real Crimes website.
She's on the Real Crimes mm-hmm. website. And Good Friday, Albuquerque police contacted Mrs. Reyes to say that they might have some connection with the site out there on the West Mesa and wanted permission to get Teresa's dental records to compare. And so far, and Mrs. Reyes agreed, but so far there has been no match. But
the timing was off, wasn't it, Pat?
Say that again?
It wasn't the time frame wrong for
Teresa went missing in 98, and these killings seem to have happened in early 2001, but I was able to point out to APD that just because they seem to have happened in 2001 didn't mean they weren't happening in 99, and so there is still a possible link. But what a horrendous thing that 13 or 14 women could be missing in a city, and there was no outcry. And that's
unbelievable.
Because they were considered not traditional victims. They were prostitutes and drug users and, you know, 14 women are missing from a community. Yes, it is unbelievable, and that's the sad thing. People don't value people anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Pat, could I ask you a question about... I don't want you to get phone calls or inquiries from people who you can't help. So for example, you are licensed, your business is in New Mexico, so somebody listens in, they're from Wyoming, for example, and they have a case, you really couldn't do much for them. I mean, you wouldn't, they shouldn't call your office or anything asking
well,
for your
assistance. Well, I don't want to send out false hope to anyone, but we have worked on cases in Florida, in Colorado, in California, by taking the body of information of records and reports and reviewing them, doing what I tell you, looking at them word for word and finding the inconsistencies, the consistencies, identifying where we think are possible leads, and we can do that. You don't have to be in a state to do, someone else there can investigate, but we can provide a body of leads to go on.
So if someone, for example, wanted their case reviewed, and we've had a few of the cases we've profiled so far, are in that position, and they either don't have the financial wherewithal to hire an investigator to review the documents, to review the case file, if you will, and look for inconsistencies, look for leads, look for suggestions of maybe an area to pursue or to explore, that people in that situation, really, regardless of where they're from, if it's a record review situation, they mm-hmm. could contact you?
They One could. Thing I'd like to insert here is that you're looking at one woman with a very small staff, and at this point, I would certainly hope that people would want to donate to the pro bono fund to make it possible for her to get larger staff to cover more of these cases, because I can't imagine how she keeps up with what she is keeping up with and still earns enough on the side in order to eat.
It's an excellent point, Lois. And the best way to donate or to learn more about you, Pat, is to visit your website. Would that be the best thing to do?
Yes, I have a website. I don't have anything that's set up to accept donations on the website, but if anybody wanted to mail a donation, there is an address. One of the things I am considering, and this might be, maybe you could give me the feedback on that, is how would you feel that families would consider a $150 case fee? That would go a long way to help offset some of the initial costs to set up a case file, make all the copies, you know, that kind of thing. I would not charge for my investigative time, but does that sound inappropriate?
To me, it sounds very, very reasonable. I'll tell you, if I were in the situation that some of these poor people are, you know, with these unanswered questions and that just fester year after year, $150, I would think, would be a very reasonable amount to cover, like you say, not investigative time, but the overhead, the copying and the filing and whatever mm-hmm. else you have to do. So I would think that would be a real bargain. Kim, what do you think?
Oh, I definitely do. I think that they should pay what they can, and if that's 200 for one person, it might be 50 for the next. But I think that that's the route I would take.
Well, we have never charged anybody any money for any case. However, mm-hmm. we have had several of the families make donations to help other cases, and that is very helpful. The apprentices don't get paid. They are volunteering their time, and it is also hard to keep a set of people for a three-year program. And right now I'm in between having an apprentice class going. So right now it is a very small staff. People do call me. I will help in any way that I can.
Pat, we've had, just like I say, a couple of the cases we've done here so far, and, you know, nobody at this point from New Mexico, but we, if that record review, you know, I don't want to see you, like Lois says, I don't want to see you deluge to the point that you throw your hands up in the air, but, and I'm not saying that, but I know we probably have a couple of people who would at least like to check with you and then see what they could possibly send and what they could work out with you, maybe to at least get a record review.
I would be happy to help wherever I could. And sometimes it's answering one question.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people just need to let somebody listen to what they're saying and say, yes, what you're saying has merit. This is what, you know, many people can do their own investigation if you just give them a couple of leads to go on.
Right. You know, I was going to ask you that. What obviously there are some people out there and are upset because of what they perceive as evidence or a poor investigation or whatever, botched investigation, if you will. that don't understand the realities or understand police procedures mm-hmm. and the legal system. And what might look funny to them or look odd to them, maybe in reality isn't. And somebody like you who looks the case record over and says, well, mm-hmm. yeah, this does maybe look a little suspicious to you, but however, you know, I've been in the business a long time, and this actually is a legitimate thing, the way they handled it or what their conclusion was. So sometimes you have to give people what they might consider bad news in the sense that mm-hmm. what looks suspicious to them isn't truly a smoking gun. When you have to do that, is it generally pretty well received? I mean, do people tend to accept that, or do they throw a temper tantrum? Or?
No, if you give them the facts, if you give them the information, if you're perceived as being an advocate against them, sure. But if you're taking what they're telling you and you're advocating for them, and then you show them how it could be this way and it could be that way, most people take it well.
Okay. But you said earlier that I don't know if you use this word. I'll use the word credibility.
Mm-hmm.
Goes a long way. It goes a long way when you're dealing with law enforcement agencies and basically coming in looking at taking a second look at how they conducted their investigation in a lot of cases, it can go a long way with getting their cooperation, at least the understanding you're a professional and that, you know, there are questions and you're trying to get some answers for the client or for the family. And also witnesses. I think Kim asked you about how witnesses receive you. And I think it's basically the same thing. If you come in with a professional attitude, and you conduct yourself as a professional, I think people see that and they'll say, "Hey, you know, this person here, I trust." And they get, and if they trust you, I think you're more apt to get a cooperation than if you come in kind of playing tough guy, you're making promises you can't possibly keep, mm-hmm. and people see through that. Would I be correct in that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So credibility is the name of the game.
In my mind, yes. Like I said, I don't measure myself in financial wealth, but if I just got a, Lois received a compliment for me, that meant a lot to me from someone who does not give out compliments and who said in this case that while I had a different perspective than they did, they felt, I've forgotten the word that they used, but that it was credible. And that was very important to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you don't have that, you don't have much if you don't have your credibility, that's for sure. Well,
Kim,
Denny, we're...
Yeah, let me just raise one other question.
Okay.
Pat, if we, if someone, one of our previous or future guests whose case is being profiled on our show, if they did want to touch base with you, should they mention that they were referred to you from this, through the Seeking Justice show?
Oh, absolutely. It helps to know, that's what I say, how did you come to call me? It helps put things in perspective. But
sure.
I will be glad to help, even if it's just answer a general question, even if it's from you or Kim. Just a general question, I'd be glad to answer it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That's really appreciated.
Thank you. And thank you, Lois. I appreciate you.
Oh, it was nice to be able to chat.
We're very
and
far
I thank
apart.
You. I thank you both for coming on. Pat, it was wonderful to talk with you tonight, and Lois, as always, and God bless you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kim.
Well, yes.
That was great news from Pat. I mean, you know, that might help a lot of these people looking for answers, and even if it's a matter of a donation, whatever they can afford. You know, to get a professional review of that file and get,
mm-hmm.
you know, even if they have to go out then and get the information themselves, but to get some kind of professional guidance as
mm-hmm.
to where to look.
Exactly.
What records
exactly.
they need to look at. So,
hey, by the way, I'm still on here, so don't talk about me behind you like that. I thought I'd better warn you. But when, we're off the air, right?
No, we're
no,
still on.
No, not yet.
We're still on the air?
Yeah. Well, Lois, you're so funny.
Well, I'm a little concerned that Pat's going to get deluged and crash. And, you know, this, which we've all just said is, you know, I don't want, she's on overload already, so that's all I'm concerned about.
Yeah, well, I think, like I said, we only had, what, two cases as far as our end of it goes, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know, you know, I'm not going to put anything out on the internet about her or anything, but perhaps a couple of the people, if they just want to call and see if she'd be interested in looking at a record. But,
yeah, and if you want any more New Mexico cases, go visit Real Crimes. I'll tell you, we've got a hunk of them. I've got another one that I'm just about ready to put. Oh, I'm just getting ready to post that new one that you're interested in.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Oh,
good. Is it permissible, Lois, if we go to the site and you know, look at a case and then I guess there's email links
yeah,
and
you,
so forth?
Yeah, then you get in touch with me and I'll put you in touch with the family.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Yeah, because the only problem is sometimes with the older cases, the family will change their email address.
Ah.
Or move, and I can't find them again.
Yes.
That people don't think to tell you. But almost all of them, I can get you in touch with them.
Great.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, Lois, thank you so much for being on and calling in tonight. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Lois.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Lois. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Thank you, Kim.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you, Denny. It was another good night. And I guess we will see you next week. We are going to be profiling the Ricky Dyer case.
Yes.
And on the 29th of September, we have Dwayne Bowers and Karen Kramer. So I'm looking forward to some great shows. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Kim, and I'm looking forward to
it. All right.
I'll talk to you next week.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye now.